This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, we look at the recent rapprochement between Israel and the United Arab Emirates. The United States brokered the deal known as the Abraham Accord between the UAE and Israel in return for a halt to Israeli annexation of Palestinian territory. Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. What does UAE-Israeli rapprochement mean for the region, especially Iran? What are the implications for the Palestinians? Does the agreement supersede the Saudi-led consensus known as the Arab Peace Initiative of 2002 that implies Arab normalization with Israel should be contingent upon an Israeli-Palestinian settlement? Does it hasten or hinder the establishment of a Palestinian state? What are the main drivers for the consummation of this deal and the timing so close to the U.S. elections? According to Matthew Lee of Fox 23 News, quote, the historic deal delivered a key foreign policy victory to U.S. President Donald Trump as he seeks re-election and reflected a changing Middle East in which shared concerns about Iran have largely overtaken traditional Arab support for Palestinians, close quote. In contrast to Egypt and Jordan, with whom Israel has peace accords, the UAE and Israel have no territorial disputes, and Emirati forces did not participate in any war against Israel. It is no secret that the UAE and Israel have long been in contact on an unofficial basis. Once again, according to Matthew Lee, quote, the announcement of the deal on August 13 was followed by the first direct commercial flight between the countries and the establishment of telephone links. UAE also announced the end of its boycott of Israel, which allows trade and commerce between the oil-rich Emirates and Israel. Israel and the UAE are slated to sign their historic deal at a White House ceremony on September 15, just a month after the agreement to establish full diplomatic relations was announced. Well, for more on the significance and implications of this rapprochement between the UAE and the State of Israel, we have two top regional analysts. Aaron David Miller is a senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace and a former State Department Middle East analyst and negotiator in Republican and Democratic administrations. He is a CNN Global Affairs analyst and the author most recently of The End of Greatness, Why America Can't Have and Doesn't Want Another Great President, and Hussein Ibish. He's a senior resident scholar at the Arab Gulf States Institute in Washington and a weekly columnist for Bloomberg and The National. He is also a regular contributor to Encounter and many other U.S. and Middle Eastern publications. And both gentlemen join me via Skype as we continue to practice social distancing. David Miller, welcome to the program.
A pleasure to be here, Carol. And it's an honor, of course, always to be here with my friend and colleague, Hussein Ibish.
And welcome to Hussein. He's a regular at these microphones. We're glad to have you back.
Great to be with both of you. Thank you so much.
So first to you, Aaron Miller, you've written a lot about this topic, both you and Hussein. What's your take on this deal, the significance, the timing? What are the main drivers?
Short-term interests of the three parties appear to coincide with potentially transformative long-term implications. I mean, I think it's quite clear the timing in the case of two of them are driven in large part by electoral considerations, both with respect to Mr. Trump and Mr. Netanyahu, although I suspect that however much hoopla and hype there is at this ceremony, it's not going to do Mr. Trump or Mr. Netanyahu much good politically. And in fact, it could actually hurt Netanyahu. It's not going to be good for his base. As far as MBZ, Mohammed bin Zayed, is concerned, I think it's a smart play. I tweeted out before, I think he, of the three, is the only one with a strategy, the only one who's not running for re-election, and the only one who is going to manage to really achieve a very concrete benefit out of this agreement, which is the delivery of F-35s, much more than a simple airplane. And while he had sought those aircraft for the last half dozen years or so, there's no doubt, even though the three may not want to admit it, that this was clearly a trade-off. So on balance, I think it's a win-win-win, although biggest win for MBZ. It's a lose for the Palestinians. Whether it is a transaction, as I've just described, or a transformation, as my friend Hussein Ibish knows, is going to depend on if and when others in the region decide to sign up. One additional point, I think it does reflect with a degree of empirical validity that I think Hussein and I would both agree on, that the region is changing. that under the cover of the Arab Peace Initiative, to which all the Arab states will continue to pay obeisance, each in their own way, at their own rate, their own time, a half dozen or so may well decide to negotiate separate and discrete arrangements, not discrete in the sense that they're private, but simply singular, separate relations with Israel.
Indeed, and that would be another blow to the Palestinians. But over to you, Hussein Ibish, for your take on the significance and the timing of the deal.
Well, I think it was a moment of opportunity where all three parties saw that they could get something they really wanted very quickly. The U.S. and Israel had gotten into a trap regarding annexation. The Trump Peace to Prosperity plan, which was issued in January, kind of invited Israel to annex large chunks of the West Bank. That would mean basically an end to the two-state solution, an end to the prospects for peace with the Palestinians under any recognizable circumstances, and it would have been very difficult. And I think Netanyahu kind of trumpeted for political reasons that he was going to do all of this, and then ran into the fact that this is a headache the Trump administration doesn't need right now. So I think Trump, having issued the plan and recognized Israeli sovereignty in Jerusalem and Golan Heights, had done enough, and thinking about anything else as a second term issue at most. And Netanyahu needed to get out of it as well. Jordan was putting up a huge stink, and the United States, I think, was telling him, you know, really don't do this. And here comes MBZ, here comes the UAE with the proposition that they can begin the normalization process with Israel if they get a bunch of stuff they want, including the F-35s, including Reaper drones, including various other very high-tech American weaponry, which they have not been able to access. And they see Israel also as the natural partner, not only against Iran, but against Turkey and the Sunni Islamists, and as another sort of tech hub in the Middle East. UAE is very fixated on the idea of becoming a major tech commercial center. And they've gone pretty far in that regard. And when they look around the region, Israel seems the natural partner in that too. So on the one hand, he could do this. On the other hand, he could say to the rest of the Arabs, look, we're saving the two-state solution. We're saving the Arab Peace Initiative. We're saving the Palestinians from the threat of annexation. We're taking one for the team, which is a bit disingenuous, because what they're really doing is pursuing their national interests in a very focused way without really paying too much attention to other details. They're a small country. They can do that in a way that would be much harder for Saudi Arabia. But that's really, I think, what's going on here. As Aaron said, it's a win-win-win. It's definitely a loss for Palestinians, but I have to say Palestinians didn't do much to help shape this reality since the Trump proposal was released. They've acted sort of paralyzed, and they still are sort of seemingly paralyzed. And they are now indulging in the grim and bitter task of accommodating themselves to a new reality that they did not try to shape and that has been forced on them. And that is the way it goes if you're passive.
Back to you, Aaron Miller, because I want to pick up on the Palestinian part. As you both said, they're sort of a loser in this deal. But again, as Hussein said, the UAE says that this deal preserves the possibility of a Palestinian state by preventing annexation of the West Bank, even though analysts say Israel had already more or less shelved its annexation plan in the face of the Trump administration opposition. Nonetheless, we understand that this is only a suspension of annexation, and that annexation has not actually, in the eyes of Israel, been actually taken off the table. Otherwise, that would really rile up Bibi's base, Aaron Miller. So where does this leave the Palestinians and their relationship with the Arab world and the possibility of a state, especially now that the Arabs seem much more concerned about countering Iran and its proxies than the establishment of a Palestinian state?
I mean, it didn't require, and I agree, formal annexation would have buried any prospects of Palestinian statehood. But creeping annexation and the de facto realities that exist on the ground make that possible reality, that is to say, a Palestinian state that most Palestinians would accept with a capital in East Jerusalem, a thought experiment. I've never, frankly, in all the years I've been doing this, seen a Palestinian national movement more divided, more dysfunctional, more demoralized than they are now. And I continue to believe, others have abandoned that hope, that something akin to separation through negotiations that would satisfy Israeli and Palestinian security and political needs is possible. But the three conditions required for that reality to even be tested are just not there. I mean, remind your listeners that July was the 20th anniversary of the ill-advised, ill-fated, ill-conceived Camp David summit. Last serious effort by an American president to bring an Israeli and Palestinian leader to Camp David. I mean, I had the honor, dubious privilege of participating in that enterprise. And frankly, the Israeli-Palestinian relationship has not yet recovered, particularly as it descended from the mountaintop in Catoctins to the Valley of Despair, known as the Second Intifada. And it has created a situation where the three ingredients that are required to even test the proposition are not there. Number one, leaders on the Israeli and Palestinian side that are masters of their political houses, not of their ideologies or their constituencies. A degree of ownership on the part of the Israelis and Palestinians to protect their own negotiations. I remind everyone that the breakthroughs in this conflict, few and far between as they have been, all occurred without the foreknowledge of the United States. Dayan shows up in Washington in October of 77, briefs my predecessors at the State Department. He's been meeting secretly with Sadat's vice president, Tahami. Israelis and Jordanians have been negotiating even in the pre-state period without the Americans. And I'm on vacation on the west coast of Florida in August of 1993. You know, I get a call from state ops. You better come back because they want a signing ceremony on the White House lawn. We knew there was an Oslo process. What we didn't know is that it was a decision-making channel, not a discussion channel. So there's no ownership on the part of either side. And finally, you need a mediator. If it's the United States, fine. If it's not, fine. It has to be somebody who knows what they're doing and are prepared to apply both honey and vinegar in pursuit of a solution. And not since James Baker, Brent Scowcroft, and George H.W. Bush have we had an American administration that understood that.
So over to you, Hussein Nebis. You talked a bit about the Palestinians, their dysfunction and lack of leadership.
Yep.
We would have to have another program to talk about the future of a possible Palestinian state. But what about the reaction of the Arab League to the UAE rapprochement with Israel?
Let me say a couple things. First, I mean, I agree with everything Aaron said. The other thing is, as far as annexation goes, I think the impression that Netanyahu gave the Israelis was very misleading on both annexation and weapons sales. I mean, he came back and he said, oh, I never let it be known that I wasn't really going to oppose these weapons sales. And clearly he did. And officials from all three countries say that privately. It's very clear he did wink and nod, and he never said, I agree, but he certainly let it be known that he wasn't going to kick up a fuss. And now the Israelis are basically saying, we can't stop this, so we're going to ask for F-22s, which is an even more esoteric American plane, and perhaps mothers of all bombs and other things they haven't been able to get. So I do think the weapons sale is going through, you know, depending on Democrats and how empowered they are after the election. The second thing is on settlements. I think it's much more off the table than Netanyahu has admitted. I think Trump said it was off the table. I think the Emiratis understand it's off the table. Now, there's no Israeli commitment never to pursue annexation or the expansion of Israeli civil law into any other part of the West Bank or anything. But I do think both the Americans and the Israelis and the Emiratis have a very strong understanding with Netanyahu that for the foreseeable future, this is not going to be raised again. In other words, it's not a matter of weeks or months. It's not even a matter of next year. It's a matter of that as long as this process is going on, they're not going to do that. And this process is not going to be overnight. An embassy is not going to be created in Tel Aviv that quickly. This is going to be rolled out because the Emiratis want to test the waters, right? They want to do it in stages. The only thing that's been agreed so far is a joint committee to do investments and to do money laundering and terrorism financing. That's it. And there's going to be a whole series of little agreements that culminate in diplomatic relations. They want to do this carefully. Now, as for the Arab League, you've seen some states being very critical, but most states in the Arab League, especially in the Gulf, not really criticizing the Emiratis, but explaining why they aren't going to go ahead and do it. So some have been very categorical, like the Kuwaitis, who never want to get involved in controversies to preserve their own domestic tranquility, who say they'll be the last to do it. And then, you know, you've got a much more nuanced reaction from Saudi Arabia, which has no criticism of the UAE, but insists it's not going to go forward with it under current circumstances. So the UAE has not been really criticized. And even President Mahmoud Abbas, the leader of the Palestinian, the PLO, and President of the PA, has issued an order to Palestinian officials, don't criticize the UAE don't get personal about this, because many Palestinian officials were very angry and they were saying all kinds of things, stabbed in the back, traitorous, all that. Obviously, that's not going to work for the Palestinians. They've been handed a big bag of lemons, but they're going to have to find a way of making lemonade out of it. And the one thing that does need to be said is there isn't much the UAE can do for Palestinians, you know, if they have no relations with Israel or just covert relations, except provide leverage in the form of goodies as the API anticipated. But once they have relations with the Israelis, maybe it will kind of weaken the Palestinian hand in terms of using relations with Arab and Muslim countries as an additional inducement for the Israelis. But on a more day-to-day level, which is probably what's available at the moment for all the reasons that Aaron pointed out, it's precisely those Arab countries, Egypt and Jordan, that have working relations with Israel that have been able to effectively intercede with the Israelis, you know, to make changes in the lives of Palestinians. And the only exception there is Qatar, which is willing to pay for the basically daily life. What they're paying is the salaries of civil servants in public employees in Gaza. And they're willing to do it because they have good relations with Hamas and everyone needs them. The Israelis, the Americans, the Egyptians, the Palestinian Authority, everybody needs somebody to keep people fed in Gaza, right? So the Qataris are willing to do it, so they do it. Because Aaron's right, there isn't any prospect for any major diplomatic breakthrough. You got to prevent disasters like annexation, and some of the settlements Israel is now considering building are very damaging. But you've got to work on conditions on the ground to create precisely the framework for that. And that means exactly that those Arab countries that do have working relations with Israel can do useful things. And once the Palestinians are over their outrage with the UAE, hopefully they can use this as a path back to dealing with Israel again so that they can get their tax money from the Israelis and resume security cooperation at a high level and get things back on track. And I think, you know, ultimately, no matter how angry they are with Abu Dhabi, the UAE can and might well be willing to be useful to them in terms of keeping the ball in the air and daily life and stuff like that.
We'll have more in just a moment. But first, you're listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. My guests are Aaron David Miller, former State Department Middle East analyst and negotiator, currently senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, and Hussein Ibish, from whom you just heard, senior resident scholar at the Arab Gulf States Institute in Washington. They join me via Skype. We are discussing the reasons behind and implications of the normalization of relations between Israel and the United Arab Emirates. This is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available for free download on our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow us on Twitter or connect with us on Facebook. Here's a shout out to a loyal Facebook fan, Bayoku Taiwo from Idofian, Kwara State in Nigeria. If you want to hear your name and home country on the air, please send an email to encounter@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Now back to our program. Aaron David Miller, we don't have a lot of time left, so let's go quickly on the weapons, the so-called F-35 advanced combat aircraft that UAE wants out of this deal from the United States. Do you see any impediments to that in Congress?
I do. Whether or not that means that an administration, whether it's a Democratic or Republican administration, won't have its way on the issue of arms sales is another matter. Thinking back now, I don't believe there's a single arms sale that any administration wanted, including selling F-15s, F-16s, AWACS, or any commodity, including an agreement with Iran, that a willful U.S. president couldn't get through Congress. The reality is, as unhappy as Congress is, certainly with the Saudis, you see the lack of influence they've had. They may have constrained the administration for a time, but a Secretary of State and a U.S. president's tremendous discretion, tremendous authority in foreign policy to do as they will. So I suspect if the normalization deal holds and it appears to be moving forward, that whether Trump is reelected or Joe Biden becomes the U.S. president, that the Emiratis will get their F-35s.
I just want to say, I think it'll be easier for President Biden. Any administration probably ran this through, as Aaron said, and they could use emergency provisions, as was done last year regarding the Yemen war and sales to Saudi Arabia and the UAE. But I think that if Biden is elected, the mainstream Democrats are going to be ascendant, and they're going to have no incentive to block this. Republicans are going to want to support it because it's Trump's signature achievement in many ways. The Democrats are going to want to support it so Biden can steal some of his thunder, and they're very pleased with the UAE. Where it becomes problematic is if Trump is reelected and there is an empowered Democratic majority in the House and even the Senate, and then the Democrats have an incentive to try to rein on Trump's parade, and you would have the left wing of the party ascendant because Biden has lost and they would be, I told you so, and AOC would become very powerful, Bernie Sanders and all these people. They're dubious of Israel, hostile to the Gulf, and unenthusiastic about weapons sales. And then you might see that Trump would have to use, you know, emergency provisions. We have a big fight about it.
Excellent. Great for bringing the domestic U.S. angle into it. So over to you again, Aaron. What does this deal do in terms of combating Iran's influence in the region? Does it put a greater squeeze on Iran?
As a political matter, sure, because it starts to break down the Arab consensus with respect to what Arab states are willing and able to do, how closely they want to affiliate and associate with the United States. But as a practical matter, I just have never bought that the Saudis were this tip of the spear in terms of our vanguard effort to constrain, if not fight Iran. And I do not believe that the Emiratis, with thousands of Iranian businesses in the Emirates and all kinds of mutual agreements with Iran and exposed, they are vulnerable, wants to put themselves in a position where, in fact, you see a buildup of tensions. I think that would be bad for Dubai, bad for business. I think the Emirates are going to be very wary of tethering themselves to an administration that somehow thinks that it can overthrow or teach the Iranians a lesson.
Exactly. And again, we're up against the election. We don't know if Biden wins. It could be a different scenario. But Hussein Ibish, we know that this deal strengthens Israel and the UAE against Iran, and it gives UAE a little more leverage over neighboring Qatar. Yeah. Anything to add or subtract?
Yeah, and Turkey. I think there are several reasons why the UAE went first and not Oman or Bahrain or any of the others who might have done this and probably will if it goes well for the UAE, which everyone is watching. The UAE not only has the Iranian angle and the wanting to get closer to Israel, they also have that commercial angle and the tech angle, but also the Israelis and the Emiratis, along with the Egyptians, don't view the Middle East as a binary contest between pro and anti-Iranian forces. They see Turkey as the hub of a third bloc, a Sunni Islamist bloc. And I think that where you'd find the UAE, Israel, and Egypt disagreeing with most of the other Middle Eastern countries is what kind of a threat it is and how seriously to take it. So it's also a kind of a stand against Turkey in a way and strengthening, and it's strategic diversification for both of those parties, as both of them and all U.S. allies question how much longer they can rely on the United States. So they're working together and making friends with Russia and China, and both of them, the UAE and Israel, have been one of the leading countries in the Middle East in reaching out to Russia and pursuing China. And this is part of that whole equation.
The last question, who's next, Aaron? Oman, Bahrain? I mean, what do you see following the UAE? Who do you see in the Gulf or anywhere else perhaps following in the footsteps?
Who else is going to sign up for the party and when is impossible to say. I would only say that if I were running the railroads in these countries, I would basically wait.
Yeah, they're all doing that.
Wait the outcome of the election before I did anything or frankly gave anything away for free.
That's right. The biggest candidate is Bahrain, mainly because Oman is going through a transition with Sultan Haitham just having come in. Bahrain is very interested, but they defer to Riyadh. They defer to Saudi Arabia on foreign and defense policy. So it would depend on how keen Saudi Arabia is to encourage them to do this, to have a second test case. I think if you have one test case, it's probably enough for the meanwhile. And everybody wants to see if the UAE is being taken for a ride or if they're really going to get, you know, all the benefits so that they can make their own calculations.
All right, gentlemen, on that note, that's all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. We'll look forward to this historic deal, the ceremony on September 15th. For now, I'd like to thank my guests, Aaron David Miller, Senior Fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, and Hussein Ibish, Senior Resident Scholar at the Arab Gulf States Institute in Washington. Gentlemen, thanks so much for your outstanding insights.
Thank you, Carol.
Sure. Encounter was produced in Washington with technical assistance from Gary Jaffe. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on the Voice of America.